This is Bird Note. Some swifts and frigate birds stay aloft for months at a time. Scientists know this because they attached sensors to the birds. What they hadn't been able to learn for certain was whether birds might be sleeping on the wing, and if they do, for how long. It was thought that one half of a bird's brain might sleep at a time, as happens with some birds when resting on the ground. A 2016 study provided some solid answers. Tiny devices attached to the heads of frigate birds tracked electroencephalograph patterns and, crucially, head movements. The results were fascinating. Frigate birds did sleep while aloft, most often one half of the brain at a time, as suspected, but they also fell into normal whole brain sleep and sometimes even deeper REM sleep. But this deepest sleep came in bursts of just a few seconds, during which time the bird's head dipped, but its flight pattern stayed steady. An in-flight power nap. So frigate birds do sleep on the wing, just not very much. On average, 42 minutes per day. When perched on land, they sleep 12 hours a day. What still has scientists puzzled is how they can get by with so little sleep when flying for months at a time. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for today. My name is Aaron Wang, and I am joined by Mihai Kovasar and Brandon Brownlee. Today, this is my show, and I am really looking forward to it. We're talking about Karl Popper, who wrote a book called The Open Societies and Their Enemies, and Plato. I've titled it Questions of Political Authority and Philosophy. I have been trying to unravel the complicated web that is the idea of utopia. Ever since I read Thomas More's Utopia, I think a little over 2 years ago now. And when I read it, I was thinking, like, this is really good. This is actually really cool. I'm enjoying this book. I'm enjoying this vision of a society where we don't have an oppressive class of nobility who are always fighting amongst each other and taking too many taxes and doing whatever they want. It's from someone like Thomas More, who lived under Henry VIII in a very hazardous period in English history. It's like there's something really attractive about a government where you don't have all of these status and power games, and people can just choose the religion they want to believe in. People can are always taken care of, and they all have a right to classical education, something that was only for the rich, only for the powerful, and only for the educated at that time period. So I was like, okay, this is like pretty great. I don't see why anyone would have a problem with this version of utopia. And then I kept reading. I read this book called Utopia for Realists by a Dutch historian. And it's the subtitle for that is The Case for Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Work Week. Those are kind of different things than what Thomas More was talking about in his Utopia. He's probably wasn't advocating for universal basic. Actually, he was advocating for universal basic income. He does do that. And the 15-Hour Work Week, he also does that. That's also true. So there's a lot less work. There is social support. Open borders, not at all. The Utopians have a very strong military and actively participate in colonization, although it's a very specific type of colonization. So those were two perspectives on utopia that I had. And then recently I've been reading Karl Popper's work on open society and its enemies. And what he takes the stance that Plato, in his attempt to create an ideal society or a picture of an ideal society is actually a utopian. But he says this in a negative way. And I've read a few people who take utopian in a negative way, but I hadn't actually engaged with the arguments about why it's negative to think about a better society or a perfect or ideal society and how we might get there. I'm still very naive in this. I'm like, hey, you know, you want to make society better? You want to have an ideal society? Sure, why don't we talk about it? What could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong hoping to make the world a better place? How could that ever go wrong? I've gotten to the point of, it's like, details really matter in these types of political arguments and systems. I read Friedrich Hayek's book, The Road to Slavery, where he talks about the perils of central planning and the assumptions of a lot of European intellectuals at that time around the Second World War, where people were just saying, you know, if we just centrally plan all of our government systems, things will be innately better because central planning is good. That is a dangerous kind of thinking.
I think this is going to be an interesting discussion because the other, maybe not the only other, but another way of interpreting the Republic and, you know, the entire project of this sort of dramatic discourse or dialogue regarding the ideal state, which is the method that I'm currently taking in my classical political theory course, is quite the opposite in the sense that the ideal society is meant to be and look ridiculous. Plato's city, Socrates's city, I should say, because again, there's another debate, which is it Plato or is it Socrates? I'm kind of the camp that it is mostly Socrates being fairly accurately depicted by Plato in writing. But anyways, that's something we can argue about. But Socrates is doing a lot of this work to be intentionally, to draw our attention to all the ridiculous elements that are necessary to produce what his interlocutors believe is an ideal society. And really, it's this interplay, as you said, you mentioned this, and I want to focus on it, between image and reality, between the idea of the city and how it would actually be in practice, which it wouldn't be. I guess in a sense you could see it as a kind of utopian process or project, but I don't think that's the aim. Especially as we start to discuss the ideas of different regime types, you really start to see that yes, their proposition for how to rule the ideal city, they may believe it's the best regime type, but it doesn't necessarily come with all of the other attachments that make the city in speech sound so ridiculous. So that's the kind of opposing take that I'll probably use throughout this discussion on the different points that you brought up, which I frankly do not remember them all in as you presented them. So we're going to have to go one by one. But yeah, that's a perspective I think I'll take today.
It's a polyphonic text, right? We have multiple voices speaking to multiple projects. You bring down this distinction between the Platonic voice and the Socratic voice. There is obviously this dialogue between Plato and Socrates going on. The way that, or one way that I was shown into the text is actually a dialogue between Socrates and Glaucon, and that the text can be read as an attempt to redeem Glaucon's soul in a certain way, right? I bring this up to say that, yes, there are utopian elements and there is this absurd city and speech, the Kallipolis that we discuss, but we also have this passed over true and healthy city that Glaucon just calls the city for pigs right at the beginning. So there's so much ambiguity going on as to even what city we're really, well, no, obviously we talk about the Kallipolis, the city in speech for 10 books or 9 books, but is the utopian vision this true and healthy city, what Socrates recommends on his particular kind of distinctions that he draws, or are we just kind of falling down the stairs with Glaucon for 9 books? You know, is that really what's absurd? If Plato is launching criticisms against these are criticisms of a particular character, right? Glaucon's character shapes and guides the way that he answers the questions that Socrates asks. You know, he says, when Socrates says, well, if we're going to expand, we had to go to war. And Glaucon's like, yep, that's inevitable. Like, there's just no problem with that, right? So the kind of character that Glaucon has shapes the way that we go down and construct this ideal city. And I think that also there's, you know, various points of Socrates trying to point this out or make Glaucon conscious of it, or, you know, as he presents in the image of the cave, to turn his soul around. Again, one reason why another reading can be trying to save Glaucon in a certain way. But again, this just goes to point up to the ambiguity of the text and the richness of that this ambiguity provides, right? It's why when I think about Karl Popper's kind of critique of Plato, well, it's certainly possible to critique Plato, but it's another thing to pin down Plato's meaning, right? There is this, I wish I remember where it was, but there is a dream recalled where Plato, he had a dream and he said, I dreamt I was a goose and I was flying between treetops and these people, you know, these goose catchers were trying to catch me. And Kebes, he interprets Plato's dream and he says, Plato, this dream means that no one will ever pin down your meaning. And I'm sure that pleased Plato quite a bit. So the ambiguity that if what Popper is saying is there's a clear and unambiguous meaning to this text, Plato is advocating for like an authoritarian state. I am skeptical of that just from my reading of it as a, not just a treatise on politics, you know, Peripoliteia, but as a piece of literature. I think that there is more going on here. So I think this will, this is why I was looking really forward to this discussion.
Yeah, and just, sorry, briefly, one really brief thing is also remembering that it's a discussion about the city and the soul, or better said, a discussion about the soul with the city as its analog, which, you know, I don't want to make this an entire discussion about the Republic. Like, I'm willing to take it your way, Aaron, and sort of talk about political rule and what they're actually proposing, because it is about that, but to see it only as a discussion about politics might be part of the shortfall. But anyways, please carry on and take us to the next point.
Yeah, so I think to respond a little bit to what Brandon was saying, Popper, and I haven't finished Open Society and Its Enemies, but I've gotten a good way through and done a little bit more research and digging. And I would say it is fair to say that Popper does believe that Plato is advocating for an authoritarian society. A strictly authoritarian society. An example of that is how he views education, where he believes that at some point in time, all children should be taken by their parents and raised by the state and then used by the state to fulfill the purposes of the state. So I think that's a fairly accurate representation of his belief. So about Plato, which he says Plato is taking from the Spartan model, which is a model that did exist in history where, what were the Spartans trying to do? They were trying to dominate other people as slaves. That is the entire purpose of the Spartan existence. It is to be the, I know this sounds awful, but to be the master people over the slave populations. That was the entire framing of what it meant to be a Spartan, is that one day the slaves are going to rise up and they're going to take everything from us, and so we have to do everything possible to be strong, to be militarily competent. We have to have a super, super strict, disciplined society that basically is nothing more than an army camp perpetually, and that is what society ought to be so that we can maintain our rulership over the slaves. Some people have some illusions about that being a wonderful thing because it helped women in that society have some amount of economic freedom and rights. That actually is true. Women in Sparta inherited equally, and because many men died in war, the women inherited more often than men, and because they were alive, and because of that, there were actually a lot of women in Sparta who were actually quite wealthy, and they had a good deal amount of political influence, although they were strictly forbidden from taking a place in a seat at the assemblies, which were strictly oligarchical. So that was Sparta. I don't think that is something that we would today consider utopian, but I do think, or utopian in the sense of this is a better society and a way that we would like the world to move to. And I think maybe I should stop there and talk about that for a bit, because when I was thinking about the idea of how do we define the word utopia and how do we define the word utopian, there's this loose characterization of there's something I don't like about the world. In Thomas More's point of view, it was he didn't like the kings and the petty politics of European nobility. And he wanted to remove that from society and create a society without those things. Now, he also had some positive, important things. But what makes his utopia better than the society he lived in is that it doesn't have these pointless power struggles over religion and over political authority and power in the everyday life of the people of England. During that period of time, England was in a period of political turmoil, and there was constant worrying over, like, are we going to be a Catholic country or a Protestant country? Does that mean we're going to have another violent revolution? Should we support this king or should we support that king? When this king, and then of course there's the breaking with the Catholic Church, and, you know, like, does the king, should the king's authority be subject to the church? Or the church's authority, if that isn't the case, then what should be the church's role with regard to that state and that time period? So the reason I go into those details is when I think about utopian, how I think about it is, there are some people who believe that society ought to be better in a certain way because they see some reality that is causing pain or harm, and they wish to remove that reality from society. So when someone creates a utopian vision, it's because they believe they can remove something that is detrimental to society and create a better society by the removal of that thing. Now, there are other ways of defining it. But I think if we took the example of socialism, which is somewhat related to Thomas More, not really, because those ideas developed later, where private individuals do not have the right to own property, but instead all property is held in common. That fixes all of the issues over private property disputes. Then the question becomes, well, then how do you maintain a society where everything is held in common? Obviously, there are small communities, like religious communities and monasteries, that have existed for thousands of years all over the globe. There are smaller communities, such as the Amish and the Hutterites in the United States and Canada, that have had arrangements for holding things in common as a group for a long period of time. So communal ownership, or even the idea of co-ops, like, that's not something that we're that hasn't worked in some situations. But that said, I also don't think you could say that, like, well, could we really do without any type of private ownership? I don't think so. Not in the modern day. Socialism does seem to believe that, and I think it does meet that criteria of utopian vision of society by removing private property from society and saying that will make things better. So that's where I'm sitting with the idea of utopia and utopian. We'll obviously go back to the Republic, but do either of you have any comments on that before we move forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to say that when someone is seeking utopia, they're seeking the best possible arrangement of a political and social structure for usually the benefit of a majority of citizens, and as far as, like, human rights are concerned and basic needs. This is why you tend to see, as you say, utopian visions and utopian, like, projects more, let's say, on the left side of politics than the right, though I guess there are probably conservative utopias and whatnot. It's insofar as utopia is an ideal. Again, I think as we start talking about the Republic again, it'll become clear that some of the practical necessities for utopia. I think that's where some of the criticism lies. Some of the criticism that's portrayed as actually support of their utopian project. It's actually Socrates saying, look at all these bizarre impracticalities which is usually the argument against utopia, right? I mean, it's an ideal, but it's not achievable for XYZ reasons. So there's that element. And also when you said that, you know, Popper's argument is that, Socrates envisions it like an authoritarian utopia. Maybe by our definitions today, but I think it's going to be important to characterize aristocracy as opposed to tyranny, which are on the opposite ends of, you know, goodness as far as a political regime goes, but are both, I guess both could be considered authoritarian in a way. It's definitely not democratic, but there's a big difference between those two, right? So maybe I'll leave it at that for now and see what Brandon has to say.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? This idea of utopia as we see some element in society and we want to get rid of it. It makes me think of, so there's we'll bring up kind of my favorite book, Hannah Arendt's The Life and the Mind. She talks about how the philosophers are the ones who see the world and grasp the whole and they come to peace with it. It's really only the philosophers who ever do this, though, who see the whole as perfect, complete. And then against that, she says, isn't it the most obvious fact about the world that it is precisely not how it ought to be? I mean, isn't that why we do things? I'm hungry, so I go make a change about it. I go get some food. There's some project that I want to establish, so I gather like people to carry that out. Politics, I don't think utopia is necessarily about seeing a problem and wanting to address it. I think that's just politics in general. I more think of utopia as kind of like a sentimental version of social reform. So like you have complex novels that are psychologically deep and whatnot, and we characterize them as like realistic or truthful or something like that. But like if you read a romance novel and it's just kind of flowery and sentimental, it feels good, but it doesn't really present like a psychological reality like a good novel does. I think on this analogy, good politics is like a good psychological novel, one that is kind of well written. We might even consider a masterpiece or something like that. Whereas utopia is more or less just like a sentimental attempt to do that. It's seeing a change, wanting to change it, imagining that change and saying, wouldn't this be great if things were different? Well, sure, it would be great if things were different. That's what we're doing politics for. But utopia does something, again, I'm trying to characterize it as like sentimental in that way. We want to make the leap without doing the work or something like that, or envisioning. I mean, given the utopian thinkers who put all the thought that they do into it, they put a lot of work into it. But when I think about a utopian project, there's something lacking in a way that a legitimate political project gives substance to. So I think that in this regard, you know, producing all of these books, something like the Kallipolis or something like that might be utopian because it's just so simple. Like, why don't we just elect philosopher kings and then we hierarchically order society according to these, these needs that we can determine ahead of time. Like, we know what's going to come up. We know things ahead of time. We can map these things out. We know the human, we know we know what their needs are. We can predict what their wants will be and stuff like that.
I would love to see you address a classical Marxist from the time of Marx and Lenin and say, yeah, your utopia is nice, but you know, it's never going to happen. It's not a real political project. I dare say that utopian thinkers would, at least some utopian thinkers would disagree with you.
Sure, yeah, totally, yeah.
But in a sense, I'm not unsympathetic to that, to your point of view, which is to say, like, anytime you're pursuing a utopia, it doesn't actually come to be, which is part of the real interest of the Republic and of Socrates' line of thought, is that, like, yeah, this will never come to be. This can't possibly come to be without breaking apart eventually. but it's interesting to think of it in the abstract, because it allows us to ask ourselves, like, okay, what is it we're actually aiming for, and how close can we get?
Yeah. And I should say too, I'm not exactly married to this. I'm just noticing when I think about the common way of thinking of a utopia, it seems to have some analog and sentimentality. But I should say too, I think that obviously there's a lot of work that goes into the utopian thinkers. They spill a lot of ink over this stuff. And also, explicitly in the Republic, Socrates does talk about the city in heaven. Right. Even if this is never enacted, even if this is never, if this project is never sought out or constructed or manifest in any way, we can still take our bearings from it. We can still try to see it and orient ourselves towards it.
And as an alternative to the idea of inevitable decay, it's an attractive option. Which for, I think, most of Greek history or Greek ancient history, there was this idea that, you know, there was the time of the gods, and then that was the golden age. And then after that, the gods retreat, and then there's like where they sometimes visit, that's like the silver age. And then there's the bronze age, where we barely have any idea of what the gold age was like. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse. So when you contrast that religious perspective with the new philosophical perspective of, like, we can actually think about making a better state. We can think about an ideal state. We can hold that vision in our mind instead of inevitable decay, which was the religious alternative, or one of the religious alternatives. Might be oversimplifying a little bit. That is definitely something that can lead to, does lead to very different political movements and different coordinations and capacity for coordination among human beings. Like, if you have a shared vision of society can be better, or a shared belief, I should say, among people that society can be better and that we have an obligation to do something about that, people would normally think that's generally speaking better than the alternative of having a more mixed idea of what society can be and not believing that society can better. Most people would, I think, say that, like, well, I think it would be generally a good thing if everyone believed that society could be better and was working towards achieving that. Or is that actually what we should be believing? Or is that just a trick of Western philosophy and that's all an illusion? Because Karl Popper would say it is an illusion. He would say that is a belief in historicism. It's a belief that things should happen a certain way, because history teaches us that things always happen in these certain ways, and they'll always happen unless we behave in these certain ways, and then history will be in this other certain way, and that is an objectively a great thing. The problem with that is that history isn't like a jack-in-a-box. It isn't like you study the past and the past is like, okay, this is what happened in the past, this is what you have to do now, and it will make the world a better place, and this is 100% objectively the only thing you should do to make society better, because that's what you should do. History isn't clear-cut. It can be, as Popper points out, prone to randomness, prone to chaos, prone to a whole bunch of other things besides the intentions or the actions of specific individuals. So assuming that, for the sake of argument, you could make all of society better as one individual, if all individuals acted by a single set program, let's say that program is a very good program. Assuming all of those individuals exist in different spaces and times and different cultures and places, it's highly unlikely that even if you created a perfect, or let's say a mathematically optimal program, it probably wouldn't be 100% effective, even under the very best conditions. And maybe this is too abstract, but let me try to make it simpler for our audience. If you had a book from one of your parents, let's say your father, and it said, you know, this is the story of my life and the